morning, Texas Tech. We're here with Mariah Dessa Ikeretali, poet, professor, and author, who is speaking on Monday night at Texas Tech University, who's a part of the Women's Studies program. And she will be hosting a workshop Monday afternoon as well. And we're just so, truly, I could not be more happy to have you here in the studio with us.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here with you.
Now, tell us a little bit about your poetry.
Oh, my goodness. well, I've been writing poetry for a really, really long time. Since I think I understood what poetry was and knew how to write, I've been writing. And when I was about 16, I decided I was going to be a writer, right? And when I decided I was going to be a writer, I decided that I was going to write, in a sense, to make people feel good about who they are, and to make people, to kind of fill in gaps. Let's put it like that, to fill in gaps in stories that are out there. And so I write with that in mind. I write a lot about issues, social issues, a lot about sexism, racism, and right now, actually, I find myself writing a lot about ancestry, survival, and actually issues of mental illness. So I find, you know, my writing is, it's shifting and it's changing, but generally the purpose of it tends to be the same.
Now, I've heard a little bit of your poetry, and it's very personal. Mm-hmm. What's it like to put that out there for the world to see? I almost feel like it's your diary, your journal. Mm-hmm. You're exposed.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting. I'm going to be talking a little bit about this. I think that at the point where I can actually put something down and create art out of it, I'm working through it, you know, or I've kind of worked through it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so when I put it out, when I share it, it's mostly so that other people who maybe have been through something similar have a reference or a space where they can go and know, okay, you know, this happens, it has happened, and I could live through this, you know, I could survive this. And I think it's part of what I'm here to do. So most of the time it doesn't feel like anything. I know that sounds strange, but I feel like that's what I'm here to do. When people come and talk to me afterwards, though, that's when it hits me. Like,
what's the reaction most common you get from your poetry?
A lot of people can relate to some of the work, which is sad, actually, in a sense, you know. There are some poems in particular that really hit people. I've had people come up to me sometimes. They're crying, you know, they've heard a poem that touches something that they've experienced. And I, because I'm writing different sorts of things now, I also have people come up to me smiling and laughing. You know, I don't have those poems with me in studio, but I actually have written a poem about having gaps in my teeth. And the response to that poem was that a young man came up to me, he said nothing, and he just smiled, and he had a gap in his teeth, you know? So depending on what the content is, people come up and they have multiple reactions. But a lot of times I get the feeling that I'm saying something that maybe someone has wanted to say but didn't find the words to.
Mm-hmm. What is some of the specific content and some of the specific situations that you have to address in some of your work?
Good question. I have written about lynching. I've written about rape. I've written about murder of children, you know, specifically black and brown children at the hands of police officers. I've written a lot about love. And I've written about family stories, quite a bit about family stories. I'm writing more about those stories right now, you know, how people manage to survive trauma, things like that.
Some of the people that come up to you and talk to you about how inspired they've been by your work, I know that in history, family culture has been very, very strong for many African Americans. Do you still think that's the case today, or do you think it's they've been affected by some of the society things the internet has done, pulling families apart, et cetera, et cetera?
That's a good question. I think there are a number of things. I mean, we talk about this sometimes in my class, the pull from the collective to the individual, right? So, like, I think that in the past, people pulled together because they had to and because they knew that there was something common that they had to struggle for, you know? We have to struggle so that we can get better housing, or we have to struggle so that our children can go to school with proper learning materials, right? And that causes people to pull together. And then sometimes once people get the things that they need, right, that's one thing, you know, communities disperse, or because movements get really, really strong. And this is very political what I'm about to say, but I just have to say it. Things happen to co-opt movements. And you notice that families sometimes suffer from that type of co-optation. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It does make a lot of sense.
What do you try to accomplish through your work, particularly your poetry? Is it for the purpose of entertaining others, informing an audience, or simply an art you take pride in? I know you said you like when people come up to you. So I'm sure you don't publish every single poem you write. Is it partly cathartic for you? And tension relieving?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. It serves multiple purposes. I think when I initially started writing poetry, it was for myself, right? It was to stop feeling like an outsider. Writers often say that, you know, at some point in your life, you were an outsider, right? And the more I wrote, the more I started to see the power of writing. You know, that you could write and you could actually affect the way someone feels about him or herself, right? You could write and you can introduce ideas to people that maybe they had but didn't articulate, or maybe they had things they hadn't thought about. You know, I know that's what writing did for me. That's what reading did for me, you know, introduced all these different ideas. And so once I decided this is what I was going to do, I wanted to inform people. That was really, really important for me. And then another thing is a healing aspect. And so it's a great thing that, you know, there's a difference between what I write that's not fully, that doesn't go full circle, because I tend not to put out things that don't go full circle. Does that make sense? Like, if there's no healing aspect to it, if it just kind of stays in one place, then it's probably my diary entry and it's got to stay in there, you know? But if it can do something possibly to uplift, or if it can drop something on somebody, as we used to say, you know, that they need dropped on them, then that's what I'll put out.
Do you think that many modern day struggles that are very valid kind of get disregarded because of advancements that have been made prior? Do you think that a lot of times things are ignored just because people assume that those problems have already been taken care of?
Oh, definitely, definitely. People, I mean, think about, there's so many issues that we could talk about where people go, that's, you know, they're just complaining again or whatever. And you realize that it's a real problem. You know, I mean, they're, oh my gosh, we could get into so many different things. But
Name something specific.
I will. I want to be really specific. I was thinking about, you know, the issue of the young woman who was raped in India. And the issue of the young woman who was, well, she was 16, who was raped in Ohio, right? Like gang raped. And so there's this kind of, well, you know, the football team is important, you know, so we oughtn't discuss this matter. Or, hey, you know, these kids, they didn't really know what they were doing, you know, this type of thing, you know, oh, well, you know, the girl needed an excuse for why she was drugged or, you know, I mean, just really crazy things. You would think that in a humane space, in a humane society, you would never blame a 16-year-old for something like that, right? You know, so you have issues like that. And, of course, you have issues of race, you know. And I think, too, you know, issues, things dealing with the environment. You can say, oh, we've got all this technology, we've got all these things, we know better, and you turn around and it's like, but we're losing our humanity, it seems, you know?
I absolutely agree. We have a lot of African Americans here on staff or that work for us, volunteer for us, and I'm really shocked at some of the feedback that they get when I send them out to do interviews. we did a series about President Obama and questions that people would like to ask him. And I had an African-American student go out and try and ask those questions, and people wouldn't talk to him. And I was kind of shocked by that.
Well, it's, you know, depending on where you are, and it's not surprising. I mean, even, you know, I'm from New York, and you have people with all sorts of ideas and all sorts of attitudes all over the planet. And I guess it's got to start when they're young. We've got to teach each other that we're all human beings, right? We're all people, and we've all got to share this space.
You've lived literally all over the place, in Europe and in New York and in the South. Is there a place where you feel like race issues will never be at the forefront of somebody's mind? Do you encounter that on a regular basis?
I have never been anywhere like that, you know. When I lived in Namibia, you know, which is in southern Africa, was so interesting because there we didn't have the issue of race in our faces, but what we had was the issue of tribe, you know, the group that a person is from. And, you know, oh, we're from this group, we're from that group. And still you had the, wow, because that's one of the last places to gain independence. You still had these really ugly remnants of racism. So you have this strange mix of things going on. I can't say I've been anywhere where people are just like, we're all the same and it's all good.
Do you feel like it's more hidden in some places than being in your face? Because
definitely.
Like I would agree with that statement. But would you mind elaborating?
Yeah, I think when you say it's more in your face, definitely. I mean, you know, there are people who say all sorts of things to you in a very sophisticated way. Like, you know, you might be talking about writing, for example, and they'll say something really condescending, you know, about, well, you know, that's just, you know, people are just writing about what they feel, but that's not really poetry, you know, that's just, you know, that's not legitimate, you know. And you're going, okay, well, according to who? Right.
I thought the point of poetry was to express yourself.
Exactly. That's what you thought, right? But you will have people who will tell you, well, you know, craft, you know, and I know craft is very important, but you'll have people who will come to you, you know, you've been writing 17 years, publishing for, you know, for however long, and well, but craft. And it's like, you think that I don't know something about craft, you know? So that's kind of a hidden way of getting at somebody, you know, or, you know, oh, so what are you teaching now in your classroom, you know? The canon in and of itself can be racist.
I would agree. Sorry, Marcella.
So you've traveled a lot, right?
Yes.
How is the racism different from like New York to Texas? I've never been anywhere really outside of Texas, so I don't even feel the racism when it happens here.
Yeah. Well, see, I can't speak on Texas because I just got here.
Or
okay.
In other places in the South, because South and North are
I bet
very
you'll figure it out pretty fast.
Oh, gosh. I hope not.
You said you lived in Alabama, right?
I did, but I went to Tuskegee University, which is a historically black college. So, you know, when I go out, I tend to pay attention to where I'm going. I will tell you this. This is something that I thought was funny, and it relates to Marissa's question. When I was in Berkeley, California, which is known as like this hippie, you know, open space, right? I was in the parking lot of Whole Foods. That was the first time I heard anybody call somebody the N-word, was in the parking lot of Whole Foods in Berkeley. And so, I mean, I thought, well, isn't that interesting? You know, here everyone is supposed to be so like liberal and loving and hippie. And
well, was it in a friendly way? Because people say it like, oh,
oh no.
my gosh, Marissa,
I'm
no.
Sorry.
No, it was.
Okay. I think she'd know the difference.
Yeah, no, this guy was really, really angry. And you know what? Marissa brings up an interesting point, because discussions I have with my students about the N-word, as I call it, they are very interesting. I mean, it's a younger generation who uses words in a way that I would not necessarily use the word, right?
Now, what do they say in those discussions?
They say that it's not meant the same way.
Do they feel like they're taking ownership of the word?
Yes.
I don't understand that. I still, if something was meant in a derogatory way, just because you are now saying it doesn't mean you've taken the meaning away from it. And I feel like it blurs the lines of, is it appropriate for someone else to say it because you're now saying it?
Right. And we discussed that in the classroom too. But what I end up saying to my students is that I think that someone dropped the ball in between my generation and their generation. Right. So if they feel that it's okay to use that word, the chances are that they haven't been steeped really deeply in the history of the word and how injurious it has been to a lot of other people, you know. And so I don't look at them like, oh, you guys are just so, I listen to them and respect their viewpoints, although I don't share it. And I really do feel like somebody dropped the ball, you know.
So I'm from New York originally. You're
Yay.
From New York. Yeah, right. I'm a big Spike Lee fan.
Yes.
I like everything he does, but one of my favorites is Do the Right Thing.
Mine too.
And I watch it quite a bit during Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And my question is, do you think it's still relevant today? And was it and is it still a decent representation of modern day urban racism? I know it takes place in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn and... You know, right now you live in Jamaica, Queens, but I just maybe add something on that.
You know, it's so funny. I love that question. I love Do the Right Thing. It's a beautiful movie. And even today, I mean, you know, there are certain things that are based in that time period, you know, like somebody getting sneakers and then one person scuffing them and, oh, you know, well, what are you doing here? You know, some of the things that are addressed in there, like, I mean, gentrification with the guy, and the guy's like, hey, listen, you know, like the guy, I think the guy ends up
the
being
mayor.
Yeah, he's like, well, he ends up being from there, right? The guy who like steps on the shoe.
The Celtics jersey.
Yeah. It's like this whole, you know, I mean, that's a big deal, actually. In New York right now. It's a big deal. And I feel like that the Spike Lee must have seen that coming, right? I think it's pretty representative of New York. We've still got all these pockets of people who are separated in a sense, you know. But money and class are probably the hugest issues that we're dealing with in New York now, which of course is tied up with race. Right. But I will tell you that when I living in New York, what I see more and more is that we are being so divided by who has the ability to afford to enjoy New York and who doesn't. That's really, really what I see. And the less you have, the more cornered you are, you know, and the more cornered you are, the more dangerous the space you're in becomes.
Right.
Do you feel like that probably echoes in a lot of college environments as well? Because I know, I mean, I'm having to pay for college myself, and I've kind of grown up. Our family was not the richest, and my grades weren't the best in high school, so I haven't had a lot of financial aid. But I feel like there are a lot of things that I have more difficulty accessing just because of my financial situation.
Definitely. No, that I think that's a definite. In fact, a few months ago, I think the New York Times had this article about students who were first generation and the issues that they were having in understanding what they had access to on their college campus, right? And what they could do and the possibilities that were there for them. And I think 2 out of 3 of the young women, they all came from low-income families. 2 out of 3 of them dropped out. Right. And the last one, you know, she had access to all these financial packages, but there were things that she didn't understand about the paperwork. And in the end, it ends up that she's got to go and work somewhere and do this. And it just becomes it's a difficult situation, I think. And in this country where your money and your education are so linked, I think it's a real issue in getting a college education and knowing what you have, you know, what possibilities you have.
And I completely agree with that. I mean, I've seen multiple people have to including myself, have to replan my degree and change degree plans just because of financially it was impossible. There's no way that I could get into that much debt and be able to come out of it on the other side with the major that I was going to have. So I don't know. I thought that would be...
No, it's a very real issue. It's a very real issue. I mean, and when you go overseas and you see that some people get their educations for free, right?
Absolutely. You'd think that you would want to invest in any mind that was willing to work.
So you would say that class and wealth is what separates people more so than race?
I would say that class and wealth are tied to race. So I don't want to separate those things, right? I would say that I've seen class divide people of the same ethnic group, though. I would say, and that's a very, very interesting thing to see, right? Class and race, they're so linked that it's hard for me to pull them apart.
It's a different kind of discrimination entirely, is what it is, really.
Yeah, and it's an oppression, I think, that we don't really talk about, right? Well,
what Matt was talking about earlier, Spike Lee films. We're watching one in one of my classes right now, and we watched Bamboozled, which I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Okay, now you're asking me to go back in my memory. Oh, gosh.
But in one scene, the guy who owns this company is white, and the writer who works for him is black. And the white guy is, in the movie, portrayed as more black than the black guy because of his way of speaking and the way that he relates to people. And the black character in this movie is Harvard educated and doesn't use any kind of slang, ebonics, whatever. And I encountered that in high school. I was not liked by the black girls in my school because I wasn't black enough. And I don't, to this day, I still don't understand how that works. And do you see that a lot in New York? Do you see that a lot in other places?
It's an interesting question. I think I could see it, but I haven't seen it. You know what? I think one of the things I find interesting about life and about moving around and about being an artist and being a professor and being a mother and occupying all these roles is that I occupy a lot of different spaces, right? And so depending on where I am, I can switch into all sorts of different things, you know? So some of the hostility that you might encounter in one space, I can switch just like this and I won't encounter any of it because I'll change. Do you know what I mean?
Become a chameleon of your environment.
And it's just natural. It just happens like that. But what I do think is that a lot of times I think people who are under some sort of siege create ways of figuring out, well, who's with us and who's against us. And they make mistakes, right? They make mistakes in that, you know, well, you must be more like them. And then it begs the question, well, who are they? You know, who are they? At the end of the day, like when you asked about poetry, I mean, one of the things I hope is that we see that there's an us, you know, and that's that. And if we don't get this together, we are going to be in trouble, right? No matter how we speak, no matter how much money we have, we need to get this together, you know?
So it's our first Black History Month, and
yay!
Let's see how good my math is. In about 20 years without Rodney King and the LA Riots, it's really a tragedy. He died last summer. In terms of that, he was kind of a polarizing figure in the 90s, and I think it's kind of obvious that racism and prejudice clearly have a lasting impact on humans. He had an interesting life. He suffered from some substance abuse. And I'm just wondering, you know, I know he got a civil settlement, and, you know, what else could maybe the government, stuff like that, what could they have done to kind of heal him from that horrible experience or nurture him? Aside from maybe read him some of your poetry.
That's such a good question. I wonder if there's anything the government could have done, or if, you know, as human beings, he needed people to rally around him, you know, in a whole other way. I was saddened by the death of Rodney King. I mean, I remember after the whole incident when you say he was polarizing, because he said, you know, can't we all just get along? And everybody was like, what? You know, what do you mean? It's the most basic thing, though. At the end of the day, you realize there was wisdom in that statement. I don't know. It felt like it was coming from a 2-year-old. And yet, isn't that where the purest things come from? You know, this sentiment that this shouldn't be, right? And what happened to him shouldn't be, that people should feel so different, disenfranchised that they find it necessary to tear up their own neighborhood shouldn't be, Right? I mean, and I think that that's what he was getting at, you know. And so when you realize, I mean, Rodney King, he suffered. You're right. He suffered after that. He suffered physically after that. I remember hearing an interview with him that he still dealt with pain, physical pain.
The mental aspect was probably worse.
Yeah, there was the mental aspect. There was the physical aspect. And, I mean, that is why you see someone like him, you know, dying early, you know. And I think it must be really hard. In fact, I know, you want to see things change and you put forth energy to see things change. And, you know, I don't think Rodney King saw the changes that he would have liked to have seen in his lifetime. And so I think that probably that's the only way that healing could have happened for him was possibly by seeing some kind of changes, you know.
Do you think we'll ever see the change?
I have to believe that we will. I absolutely have to believe that we will, you know. I say that because there's no other reason to do the work if I don't believe that, you know. I mean, just sitting in this studio and seeing all of your faces, actually, you know, is something that gives me hope. So, you know, I have to believe we'll see the changes, you know.
It's almost like missionary work if you can just help one person.
Yeah, it feels like that, but then that one has got to, you know how they say, that one's got to go and teach the next one, and that next one has got to teach the next one, and, you know, but we'll never get anywhere if we're doing this separately. And that's what, I've come to this probably in the last few years, like understanding that this idea of the rugged individualism, you know, I think it's a myth, you know, we're a lot more rugged together as a family. You know, than we'll ever be alone.
Well, I want to hear a little bit of your poetry we've talked about this evening.
Okay,
if you don't mind sharing.
No, well, I bought a poem for Nina Simone. So I bought, like, the warrior fighter spirit here, right? So for people who may not be familiar with Nina Simone was a singer and an activist. And she did her activism largely through her art, you know, and I'm deeply inspired by Nina Simone. You know, when during the civil rights movement, she wrote a lot of songs that spoke to people, like For Women and Mississippi. Goddamn, are we allowed to say that?
No, but we can say it online.
You can say whatever you want.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. You realize I paused a lot before that? I was like,
You say whatever you want.
Yeah, no, I'm like, I know we probably shouldn't say that, but, you know, that's the name of the song, okay? So I wrote this for Nina Simone because she was powerful. Okay. It's called Her Voice. Bowl of crushed blueberries, knife edge, cracked calabash, heavy truth, ancient wine and renegade bones, rise up. Rise up, white wings of doves, tapestry of nerve, daughter of well-aimed lightning. She blinded compromise with her nail-like tongue, with her bitter root, burnt honey, tornado blackness. Bent back women walked up her throat, flew straight arrow from her mouth. Mississippi, Gullah, baptism, the Nile, Congo, belly of slave ships, Harlem, potent cocktail of her pitch black notes. She divined riots on piano keys. She was exiled and passion and turbulent ritual. She was that sound in the racing heart of thunder.
Beautiful. It really was. I loved it.
Thank you.
Well, we are
Kira's getting
out
a little
of
misty.
Time. I know. I was like, oh, it's just so beautiful. But I just want to thank you again
thank
for
you.
Coming in, Miss Tally. I feel like we've all learned so much and we just couldn't have asked for a better guest for today's show. Seriously.
That's awesome. I feel like I've learned a lot, too, actually. You all have given me a chance to think about a lot of things. And like I said, it's beautiful to see you all here doing this work.
If you were just tuning in, we were with Maridessa Ikere Tally, poet, professor, and author. And we'll be right back after this break.